You're listening to The Point. Music has long been part of life at sea, most commonly associated with the sea are shanties, the work songs once used to accompany labor aboard large merchant sailing ships. But the sea also brought different cultures into contact with one another, and that too is reflected in music. Fado, for example, has its roots in Portugal, but is popular along the south coast thanks to a large Portuguese population that came here to fish. We're going to get a sneak peek of some of the different music genres featured at this year's Working Waterfront Festival. Joining us is Laura Orleans. She's one of the founders of the Working Waterfront Festival and also the executive director of the New Bedford Fishing Heritage Center. Welcome back. Always good to see you.
Thank you, Mindy.
And joining us on the phone from Narragansett, Rhode Island is musician John Campbell. Welcome to you, John.
Hey, thank you.
Laura, music is always part of the festival. How do you decide what types of music and musicians to include?
Well, your lead-in was pretty apropos. So the fishing industry is quite ethnically diverse, and one of the things that we do is to try and reflect that in the musical choices. So this year we have Portuguese fado music. We also have a group called Noir that does Norwegian and Irish music. It's kind of a blend. So that's one piece. Fishermen like John, I mean, John fished at one point in his career, but fishermen who sing and write about their experiences and their work is another aspect. And then, of course, yes, we have sea shanties too.
John, many of your songs tell stories about fishing or being at sea. And so you are a fisherman turned musician, or have you always been a musician too?
Well, I've been playing music since I was 10 years old.
Oh.
You know, I don't know if I even today still refer to myself exclusively as a musician. You know, I mean, it's just one of the things you do.
Yeah. What's your fishing background? What did you do when you were fishing?
Well, I grew up down here where it wasn't really separate from life. You know, we did a lot of shell fishing, oystering, claw hogging, scalloping, things like that. Catch eels around the holidays.
A little bit of everything.
For the Italian dinners. And,
right.
You know, as we got older, we'd go deeper water. You know, people here, Point Judas, I mean, you'd farm sometimes, you'd fish sometimes, you'd build sometimes. I mean, it wasn't a separate compartment of life. It was just part of the fabric of life around here.
Yeah. We have a cut of yours titled Ulysses the Lobsterman. So what can you tell us about it before we hear it?
Well, I operate a lot without adult supervision most of the time. And I had the idea to maybe reset the Iliad and the Odyssey in Penobscot Bay. I thought I'd begin a few songs along those lines, you know, and picturing Ulysses encountering the sirens and stuff like that from the point of view of a lobster guy up in Maine. So, not all ideas are great ideas.
Well, let's take a listen and see.
Late last September, I was pulling some pots out by the southeast light, and I was thinking about quitting, going home early, when I beheld me a wondrous sight. It was a raven-haired beauty way out from shore, just paddling out through the swell. You know, I might have gone swimming with some bow-legged women, but none of them did it as well. She was moving along at 8 or 10 knots, and her bow wave and wake, they were fine. And I banged up my elbow and bloodied my nose as I scrambled to throw her a line. And she backed it right down and came circling around and threw a hand up on the rail. You know, the part in the sun was all a number one, but under the water was tail.
John, where do you find inspiration for the songs that tell a story?
You know, that's the most difficult question I think you could ask any artist. You know, you want to stump an artist, say to them, where do you get your ideas? You know, they just kind of come, it just kind of happens.
Yeah.
You know, I think most people would say they have very little control over it. Something during the course of the day will just strike you, and that's, and you got to run with it.
Yeah, so it just kind of pops in your head, yeah.
If I could tell a quick anecdote, we once had John play. This was separate from the festival, but he played at the Whaling Museum, and in the Jacobs Gallery, which is the sort of the area that you enter, are these massive skeletons of whales. They're quite stunning, you know.
Yeah,
you can't
so stunning
help
was the word I was thinking of. Yeah.
So that's where the concert was. It was a free event, if I remember correctly. And John was getting ready to perform and kind of looked up at the ceiling and looked down. You could see the wheels turning. And he said, you know, there's a song there somewhere. And about 3 months later, he was playing at the Working Waterfront Festival and he had penned Catch and Release. Is that what it's called, John?
Yeah, yeah.
So
you just never
know. You know, I tell people, say, well, how do you make a song? I say, well, first of all, be in an interesting place where interesting people are doing interesting things and the songs will just happen.
Yeah. You also build instruments. What got you started along that vein?
You know, building instruments that I wanted to play some instruments that weren't commercially available, or if they were, they were enormously expensive. So building an instrument is really like building a very small-scale boat in a lot of respects. Bending wood is bending wood, and, you know, there's a couple of critical lines. You got a reference point you got to keep in mind when you're building them, but it seemed like an easy jump to from building boats to building instruments.
Doesn't sound easy to me at all, but I'm glad you have that talent. One of the other things you're going to be doing at the festival is you're one of the judges for the tattoo contest. So how are you going to judge that?
Well, I think I'm going to be in charge of the ones that aren't publicly visible.
That's funny.
I think they have a set of criteria. It's going to be, you know, based on the quality of the design, the importance of the design, what sort of story goes along with it, and a few things like that.
I say, some of the artwork that's involved in some of these designs is pretty amazing. Yeah.
Right. Well, the idea came about. There's a guy in Gloucester, Joey something. He's a lobster guy up there, and I've seen a few photos he'd done in Gloucester of different fishermen, and up there they have some iconic stuff: the man at the wheel, St. Peter's Church, and the Gordon's guy, and a few things like that. And those figured very heavily in tattoos on the Gloucester guys. So I got to thinking, you know, the Portuguese influence and things like that, there must be something similar in New Bedford.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see who enters, that's for sure. John Campbell will be performing at the Working Waterfront Festival. John, thanks for joining us this morning.
Okay.
All right, Laura, Sharks Come Cruising will also be performing at the festival. Tell us a little bit more about this group.
So I think when John was referring to punk rock sea shanties, that was the group he had in mind. The Sharks are they're a band out of the Rhode Island area as well. They're young, and they kind of take the sea shanty genre, if you will, and rock it.
Yeah. Okay.
So it is a lot of fun.
And if people are trying to picture that, we have a song of Sharks Come Cruising. This is called Whoop Jamboree. Let's give a listen. Little tune, huh? They sound like they could be fun.
You know, and I think part of what all festivals, museums are trying to do is broaden the audience. So the tattoo contest definitely brings a younger crowd, I would say.
I would say all ages for that, because a lot of the fish, you know, the older fishermen certainly have
tattoos
with stories.
You know, and the tattooing tradition goes back to the days of sail and to the Navy. So we did a tattoo contest 2 years ago, and we definitely had a wide gamut of folks enter. And so I'm excited for this year.
And as we mentioned in the intro, Fado has its roots in Portugal, but is very much alive on the South Coast. So explain that connection.
So Ana Vinagre has actually been recognized by the Massachusetts Cultural Council, which is our state arts agency, for her incredible talent and dedication to sharing that. And she's been a master artist in the Traditional Arts Apprenticeship Program. So Fado is really almost a song of lament, often sung by the singer wearing black, you know, in the case of a woman, as Ana is, with a black shawl. So there's a lot of drama to it. And it's just, it's beautiful, beautiful music. And she, you know, we're so fortunate that she lives in New Bedford with her husband, José, and the two of them take turns carrying the vocals, and then their instrumentation, you know, there's traditional instrumentation with stringed instruments and the Portuguese guitarra.
Yeah. So we have a clip of Ana Vinagre, so here, let's take a listen to that.
As varinas da nossa terra, não é, meninas? Passam varinas com a giga em arco, de sobre a aerosa cabeça sobranceira, no chão lameado de ribeira, a água negra fez um grande charco. Lembram a quilha de um barco? As tabancas da peixeira. Lembram a quilha de um barco? As tabancas da peixeira. A saia rodadas são velas que o vento alarga e fustiga. São asas de caravelas em corpos de raparigas. As pernas altas são mastros que nenhum vento quebranta. Os olhos são negros astros e são faróis em terra santa. Os olhos são negros astros, são faróis em terra santa.
Wow, the guitar work and the vocals are really
great.
The
guitar work is stunning.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah.
And one thing I would say, so a couple of things. One is that's called Las Varinas, and forgive my Portuguese pronunciation, but I believe the Varinas are fish sellers.
Oh.
I've heard Ana introduce that before. And then the other thing is that that comes from the mainland of Portugal. So a lot of the fishermen come from the area around Lisbon, particularly Figueira da Foz, which is one particular community, quite a large area. And then we also have a lot of people from the islands, from the Azores, who are involved in the fishing industry. So that'll be reflected not so much in the music this time, but in the cooking demonstrations.
Mm-hmm. So is the fado pretty much more the mainland?
It is.
Yeah.
More of a mainland tradition. But I think, you know, there's a lot of shared Portuguese, you know, I think people from who speak Portuguese
understand it for sure. Yeah.
Right. Understand it and relate to it. And it, you know, it just is very evocative for them of the old country.
Yeah. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the Working Waterfront Festival with Laura Orleans. She's one of the founders and also the executive director of New Bedford's Fishing Heritage Center. The New Bedford Fishing Heritage Center and the Working Waterfront Festival are closely linked. So how long has the Heritage Center been open, and what are the kinds of exhibits and things that are currently up and running?
Sure. So the Fishing Heritage Center is in many ways an outgrowth of the festival. The center opened to the public in June of 2016, so we're just a little more than a year old. And in a way, what I was trying to explain to people is we're taking the festival and try to put it in a building, which is a challenge. The festival has its own, you know, its own life, and we're really pleased to be involved in bringing that back. So as far as the center goes, we're relatively small. We have an exhibit that's called From Boat to Table, which basically looks at all aspects of what goes into bringing seafood from the ocean to the plate. So, you know, a lot of people are certainly aware there's a boat and a crew. Right. But they don't necessarily think, well, there's somebody who's putting ice into that boat and somebody who's supplying fuel and somebody who's making a net or a dredge, somebody who's designing the vessel and building it and maintaining it and repairing it. You know, so there's that whole piece that happens before the vessel even leaves port there's life at sea, which we can only imagine if, you know, for those of us who are landlubbers. And then there's a whole network of folks who are involved once the boat offloads its catch. So there's the auction. There are people offloading that catch who are called lumpers. There's the way that fishermen are paid in a settlement, you know, settlement house that takes care of the accounting and the bookkeeping. And then there's the whole processing sector. So people that are involved in filleting and packing and, you know, all of the things that happen to get that fish and, and shrimp and, well, not shrimp so much in New Bedford, but fish and scallops and clams and lobster off to market. So that's one exhibit. And then we actually, this fall, we have a nautical tattoo exhibit that was built off of the last tattoo contest. And so it's, we had the foresight to collect stories from the contestants. So it's called Nautical Tattoos and the Stories Behind Them. And they're actually beautiful, gorgeous portraits that were taken by Phil Mello of people and their tattoos, and then direct quotes from them about what these tattoos mean. And, you know, it's funny because when I suggested that we do this, people said, well, the story's just going to be I went to the bar and I got drunk and ended up with a tattoo. But no, in fact, for many people, you know, the tattoo has huge significance. And I, you know, I can think of one in particular. There's a young man who has a tattoo of Popeye, and he explained that he's kind of a tall, lanky guy. And when he first got his position on the boat, his captain was really surprised at how strong he was because he's so skinny. And, you know, so he used to call him Popeye. And then the captain ended up dying, and the guy went out and got tattooed of Popeye just to commemorate that relationship.
Yeah, I was going to say, and also in the fishing industry, especially on the South Coast, there's many that's families. It started, you know, my father fished, my grandfather fished. And so it's sort of this kind of family business. So there's a lot of stories that relate to
multi-generational.
Ancestors.
Yeah. One of the other, I wouldn't say it's an exhibit, but it's a something that's my favorite thing, actually, that we have at the Heritage Center is a list of about 350 waterfront nicknames. And these are real names of people, some living and some, you know, who have died, who either worked as fishermen or in other capacities on the waterfront. And it's alphabetized, and we don't give the actual name. It's just the
nicknames. Just the nicknames.
And
I bet that's fun.
It's the place where anybody who has any kind of connection to the New Bedford Fairhaven waterfront walks in, and they, you know, they're just drawn to that.
And, you know, I bet when they look, they go, I know who that is.
Oh, they do. And what they say is, you know, if somebody dies and they print the obituary and they don't give the nickname, sometimes
people don't know who it was. Isn't that interesting? They didn't know their real name.
And I think a lot of that has to do back to that ethnic diversity with people from different cultures kind of mixing and blending and giving each other nicknames because sometimes they couldn't pronounce the real name or sometimes the nickname had something to do with that, you know, that connection to the old country. But one of the things that we'll be doing at some point during the festival is we've got a couple of folks who've collected nicknames. And in fact, we now have 450 in a database and we'll eventually reprint, but they're going to read the nicknames and tell some of the stories.
You are really all about collecting stories and not just, you know, audio, you know, for those oral histories, but there are a lot of stories to be told. And it's a big job that you've been working on for a long time.
This is true. And actually, to that point, so the center, you know, has these exhibits that are visible to the public, but behind the scenes, we've had an extremely busy last year and a half. We just completed a fellowship for the Library of Congress in which we conducted 58 interviews with people who work in the shoreside trades. So people who are actively working today. And it was a joy to just talk to people about what they do, how they learned, what they like about their work. You know, and a lot of times I'd go into these interviews and people would say, well, I don't know why you want to talk to me. I just drive a fuel barge. There's not much to it. And then 45 minutes later, they'd say, well, I guess what I do is kind of interesting. And, you know, I guess it is kind of an important piece.
So how do you pull that out of folks when you have somebody who sits down and goes, I'm not very interesting. Why do you want to talk to me?
You know, I think to some extent, having enough knowledge to ask the right questions, but not so much that you already know. I'm genuinely curious. And I really love to find out what makes people tick and what they're passionate about. And over and over and over again, I would hear from people, you know, my favorite question was, so tell me about a typical day. And I always knew the response was going to be, there is no typical day. And part of what they love is that there is no one day that's just like the next. Right. You know, you go in, you're a marine electronics installer, and you think you're going to be doing one thing, and then somebody's got a crisis on their boat, and you end up doing something entirely different, and you save the day, and you're a hero. So that's really neat. We also just completed a film called Finest Kind, which will be shown, I think, three times during the festival weekend. It's a 20-minute film based off of interviews with six different people. Five of them work either work in the fishing industry or are fishing family members, and just marvelous stories that came out of those interviews.
Right. And this film you said is going to be three times. Where will it be shown?
It'll be shown at the center.
At the center.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and you can walk from the waterfront to the center.
Yes. And actually, so good point. The music that we were just sharing mostly will be taking place on a stage in the parking lot of the mm-hmm. Fishing Heritage Center. Some of those musicians will also have little stints down on the contest stage. And then some of them will also play in very intimate sets inside the Fishing Heritage Center. So what we're trying to do this year with the festival is to really forge a link that was once seamless. You mm-hmm. know, back in the whaling era and all the way up until the 1970s, there was no separation between the waterfront and the town. And in the 1970s, in that urban renewal phase that many towns mm-hmm. and cities went through, there was a highway put in.
Yeah.
The city's actually been working really hard over the last 3 or 4 years to kind of, the highway's still there and it's necessary, but to kind of make it more pedestrian
friendly.
So it's
easier to cross now, though.
It is. So it is. It's about a 5-minute walk between the waterfront and downtown, but I think people don't necessarily know how to do it. And hopefully this will help people understand. We also will be running an accessible shuttle, so for people who, for whatever reason, don't feel like making the trek by, on foot.
Now, this is year 13, which just kind of blows my mind, because I remember back when you first started this, we were talking about this, and the whole idea was to educate people about what the fishing industry is all about, and not, as you're saying, all aspects of the fishing industry. And so you've had 13 years of telling these stories and bringing these folks and different skills and talents to the public. Talk a little bit about how it's evolved.
Sure. In many ways, I think what we've done is to sort of hone the best of, you know, we've figured out over the years what works, what doesn't work so well, what people are really interested in. Food is mm-hmm. always a huge draw. So not only can you eat at the festival, obviously, but we have a cooking demonstration area, and that's just, you know, always, always popular. And we do have a couple of professional chefs, but I think the thing that's most interesting is when you get home cooks. And I was really excited last night, actually, my neighbor found a mother and daughter, Portuguese, from the island of Faial, and they live in New Bedford, and they're going to be cooking a codfish salad, which is the mother created, and the daughter said, you know, I'm so glad my mom's going to do it with me, because when I make it, it doesn't come out quite the same. But the idea, again, is, you know, sort of storytelling, and the MC at that stage is a folklorist similar to myself, who's really focused on food and foodways. So part of her job is to really bring out kind of the stories, and part of what we're also trying to do is to make people aware of how wonderful seafood is, how many different ways you can prepare it, how easy it is to prepare. I think a lot of people are very afraid of.
Well, I was going to say, shucking is coming to mind when people are, and there really is a talent to that. Are you having the shucking contest again?
We are.
This year?
So, yeah, New Bedford is actually the most valuable fishing port in the nation, and that is because of our scallop industry mostly. This is the 16th year that we've been, you know,
number
had
one.
That
yeah.
number one. And so, one of the ways we show off skills is through contests and also just demos, but one of the most popular contests is absolutely the shucking contest, and that happens at noon. And it's just, if you've never seen it, it's pretty wild. On a typical 10-day scallop trip, a single fisherman will shuck about 50,000 scallops.
Oh my goodness, really?
So,
wow.
It is quite something. And I remember the very first year of the festival, somebody said to the MC, I thought there was a machine that they used to do this. And he said, there is. You're looking at it. It's these guys.
Wow.
You know, and they just, they're fast and they're thorough.
And I'm amazed because you can really hurt yourself with those. And they just seem to go boom, boom, boom.
I don't think that they so much cut themselves as the carpal tunnel aspect of it. They call it the grip.
Yeah.
And it's,
Well, fishing is a part of the fabric, of course, of New England, but the fishery is changing. We're seeing depleted fish stocks, and climate change will impact what fish we have in our waters. How are you addressing these changes in events in the festival or exhibits at the Heritage Center?
So one of the things that, since the beginning of the festival, has been fascinating to me is the ways in which fishermen and scientists are working together to sustain the resource. And we have a really good example of that, both at the School of Marine Science and Technology at UMass and also at Mass Division of Marine Fisheries. And so a number of fishery science groups will be represented at the festival talking about the research that they're doing and, you know, with all kinds of hands-on ways to convey that. So that's principally the way that we're addressing it. And I think it's important. One of the things that troubles me is that people often assume that fishermen don't really have any regard for the ocean environment or for the sustainability of the resource. And to me, that just seems crazy. I mean, if your livelihood depends on it and you have many generations in your family, you want to see it continue forever. So I think that there are, in my experience, there are many fishermen working very hard, coming up with ideas for gear, talking to scientists about, you know, we want to catch haddock and we want to avoid cod. Can you help us to do that? And, you know, and that brings in net designers and gear designers and, you know, fishery scientists who know the behavior of these animals and who can do, know the scientific method and all of that. But you also need the knowledge of fishermen who know how to set the gear and know where to find the fish from generational experience.
There's always been a little bit of tension there between the fishing and the science of, you know, folks who count the fish. And the, and do you, with these collaborations now of more of them working together, do you see that tension easing somewhat?
I think it's a matter of trust and also a matter of respect. And I think that when there is real respect given to the knowledge and skills that fishermen have, and it's not just, you know, oh, you have a PhD and you must know best, I think that those relationships can grow. And I think that's why the SMAST folks have been so successful. So, you know, pleased to partner with them in telling that part of the story as well.
Yeah. I also think from the general public, sometimes it's hard to understand, you know, what the sustainable fisheries are, what's sustainable and what's not. And that's something I think people are starting to pay more attention to. And like there's, you know, there are fish out there that people go, I don't know what to do with a dogfish,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. So, and actually New Bedford has just branded, launched a seafood branding campaign to help people understand where their fish is coming from too. So part of what we're trying to do with the cooking demos this year is to really highlight all the different types of fish that are landed here in New Bedford, or here, there in New Bedford. You know, I think that there are lots of ways to look at that issue of sustainability. And there's also a real important piece, which is sustaining a community. So I think that it's a balancing act. I would say the Northwest Atlantic Marine Alliance, for my money, has a really good approach to all of that, you know, which looks at kind of who's fishing and who's earning money. And, you know, it's not just about the fish. It's also about the fishermen and the communities. So it is a balance, and it can be very challenging.
All right. So what are your thoughts looking forward? Where do you see the fishing industry going? I'm thinking of we've done many of these programs every year on a lot of different themes, and we've had families in here where we, you know, we talked about a lot of times kids wanting to take over or be in the same fishery that their parents or parent might have been in. And now we're seeing other parents encourage their kids maybe not to go that route for many different reasons, I think. So where do you see the future? Are you optimistic?
I am optimistic. It was interesting in those 58 interviews that we did with the shoreside workers. One of the things that we heard is we can't get enough labor. We have jobs, really, you know, good paying jobs with a lot of skill that people don't, you know, they're not applying for them or they don't have the skill set needed. So one of the things that we're hoping to do in the months and years to come is to also look at the ways in which our high schools could be better preparing students to take on jobs in marine science or in shoreside work or in fishing. And in fact, because of regulatory change and other factors, we're also finding, I mean, I heard from a scallop, veteran scallop captain recently. He said, you know, there are 200 scallop vessels and there are about 20 to 25 young men who are quote unquote wheelhouse material. The average age of fishermen right now is 51 years old in the state of Massachusetts. So what's going to happen as the older guys, I mean, you know, it is a young man's game. Let's face it. It's not easy.
It's hard work.
It's very physically demanding. And so as the older people leave the fishery because, you know, they can't continue doing it when they're in their 70s, are there going to be enough young people that have the skills and knowledge to do it? So University of Rhode Island actually just instituted a pilot program to train young fishermen who are interested in getting in. So, you know, I think that there is a lot of hope looking forward. I'm hopeful and optimistic. I think that it is, you know, it's certainly a changing landscape for sure.
Average age 51. You've got a lot of stories still to collect, don't you?
We do. I mean, I can talk more about, we actually have a really exciting project that we've just launched, which is to look at the history of labor on the New Bedford
waterfront.
Oh, really?
Well, tell us about that.
So we were very fortunate to get some funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities and Mass Humanities, which is a state humanities foundation, to look at the history of labor, organized labor on the waterfront. In 1941, most of the union unions on the waterfront were formed. So there was a fishermen's union, there was a lumper's union, there was a fish cutter's union, there was a dock worker's union, there was a longshoreman's union. And then in the mid-1980s, there was a massive strike. It began right before Christmas time in 1985 and lasted about 4 months. And when the dust cleared, the unions were basically gone. And the whole face of the waterfront changed. And so 10 years ago, when I started to, you know, heard this, started asking questions because it seems like a natural watershed moment and pretty interesting. People said, oh, no, we can't talk about that. And what's interesting is in the decade that's, you know, that sort of transpired, people seem to want to talk about it now. Yeah. And so I've got fishermen coming in with their union books and I've got, you know, people just sort of coming out of the woodwork. I had a woman call recently and she said, you know, I worked in the fish houses. I don't know if you're interested in that, but I have a whole scrapbook about the strikes. I was really involved.
That's
so
great.
It's very exciting.
In the process of collecting all that material right
so
now.
So we are, and we're interviewing, you know, everyone from lawyers who represented the different unions and different businesses to elected officials and obviously the workers. And I'm really excited about this
project.
One.
Yeah. So the Working Waterfront Festival is Saturday, September 23rd on the New Bedford waterfront. It's free.
It is free.
Parking, too?
Parking is free at the Elm Street Garage.
And we'll have a link with more information about the festival and the New Bedford Fishing Heritage Center at our website, capeandislands.org. Laura Orleans, always good to see you. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.